Over the years, we have witnessed some high-profile cases of so-called sex change operations. Christine Jorgensen comes to mind in the 1950s as the first American to publicly undergo sex reassignment surgery. Born George Jorgensen to Danish-American parents, George joined the Army in 1945, but his desire to be a woman was overwhelming, and he needed to find a solution. This type of sex change surgery was illegal in most countries, and there was no surgery like that available in the United States. But George was determined and fortunate to find sympathetic surgeons and endocrinologists in Copenhagen. He underwent surgical intervention, and the hormones she took made her appear a very convincing woman. She lived as Christine Jorgensen for the rest of her life, but she became an easy target for both media and comedians of her day. Issues surrounding sexual identity, sexual orientation, and gender identity are complex and can create great angst and emotional upheaval, as well as complex decision-making for the individuals, their families, and the physicians enlisted in their care. Joining us this morning to explore this challenging and somewhat controversial subject as part of our series called Difficult Decisions in Healthcare are Dr. Gregory Eastwood, Professor of Bioethics and Humanities and Professor of Medicine at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Irene Sills, Professor of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University with a specialty in pediatric endocrinology. Welcome, Drs. Eastwood and Sills. Thank you so much for joining us this morning. Let's begin first with some definitions. Help us understand, when we say sexual identity, what do we mean?
Well, I think you mean gender identity, and that is how an individual sees themselves. Do they think that they are a boy or a girl? And that's not always concordant with their anatomy or with the gender that was assigned to them at birth.
Hmm. Is that the sexual identity the same thing then as gender identity, Dr. Eastwood?
Well, I think it depends on your point of view. I know I have a daughter who teaches sociology, and she distinguishes gender and sex. But I think from the point of view of today's discussion, they're roughly equivalent. Wouldn't you say that, Dr. Sills?
I think we reserve the term sex for what your chromosomes are, what your anatomy is, your biology. You know, what would anyone typically looking at you decide you are? Whereas gender, for the way I understand it, is more what you think you are because of the way your brain tells you you are.
Mm-hmm. In that sense, it's kind of concordant with your sexual orientation.
Well, sexual orientation is who you're attracted to. So that's a different concept. So you can be a boy attracted to a boy or a boy attracted to a girl, or you can have
or
the
both.
Biology, right? Or both, absolutely, Dr. Eastwood. Mm-hmm. Or you can have the biology of a girl, think you're a boy, and then be attracted to either boys or girls.
Okay, that's
or
very,
both.
I'm glad you clarified that, because that can be confusing to people.
Oh, enormously.
Those distinctions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what does the medical term gender dysphoria mean? Because I've heard that in reference
gender
to
dysphoria
this.
Means it's a pervasive, strong sense that the gender you were assigned at birth is not your gender. You're uncomfortable with your assignment.
And the assignment, obviously, is a reflection of your biology.
Exactly. It's mm-hmm. the way your external genitalia look, what the gynecologist or the obstetrician told your mom at the time of birth. Congratulations, you have a girl.
Mm-hmm. I understand also, Dr. Sills, that this can occur quite early in life, in young children. Would you comment on that?
Absolutely. Yeah. Now we understand that Christine Jorgensen probably, although I never spoke to her, probably had these feelings from very early childhood. The parents of the children that I take care of tell me that they knew when their kids were 3 and 4 years old that they were much more comfortable in the opposite gender from the gender they were born and assigned in.
Do you feel that there are factors, I mean, when I've been reading up on gender identity or this notion of sexual identity, they're talking sometimes about the cultural factors or the psychosocial factors involved. I mean, do we really understand how this evolves, this dysphoria, No. Or, we don't.
I don't think we have a lot of insight at all, although people are very interested in trying to understand why this evolves. But I can't say that if you do a CAT scan of the brain or an MRI or a PET scan, we're going to know why this is the case in some children.
And do we see kind of trends? In other words, if you were to look at people who have this gender dysphoria, do we see similar characteristics, familial characteristics, anything like that, Dr. Eastwood?
I don't know that this is sort of passed on in families. Dr. Sills may want to comment on that. But I think one of the characteristics of our culture in the last couple of decades is, although there are very notable exceptions, there is a much more openness to this, and therefore I think we have the impression that it's more prevalent. But I would just point out that nature doesn't know these divisions that we make. And nature obviously creates male and female, but it creates the ambiguities in between male and female. And we're the ones, humans, are the ones who put the labels on.
So you're saying that, in fact, people do exist, organisms, human organisms exist that are somewhere in the middle?
And non-human organisms. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the interesting thing.
That is very, very interesting. So very briefly, we have a little bit of time for the break. What does it mean to be transgender?
All right, so transgender is an umbrella term that includes things like transvestites. The more specific term is transsexualism for people who feel uncomfortable in their assigned gender and wish to live their life in the opposite gender.
Okay, well, hold that thought. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Linda Cohen. This is HealthLink on Air, FM News Radio 106.9 WSYR. Welcome back to HealthLink on Air. Linda Cohen along with Dr. Gregory Eastwood and Dr. Irene Sills. And we're talking about difficult decisions in gender identity. Well, we started out by giving some definitions. And the last thing we talked about was gender dysphoria. And I mentioned it was a medical term.
Right.
So tell me about that,
Dr.
Sills.
Well, right now, gender dysphoria is listed as a psychiatric disease in the listing of such diseases. Now, when you talk to parents and children, they don't think that they have a disease. They think that they're perfectly fine to feel the way they feel. It's analogy is homosexuality back in the 70s when that was listed as a disease, and then it was taken out of that listing, and we don't call people who are homosexual today diseased.
So there's the stigma, the social stigma that goes with the DSM rating, but there is some benefit to it too, isn't
well,
there?
Well, the issue is if you have a disease, you can get health insurance to pay for mental health therapy. But there are some mental health therapists who think that children with gender dysphoria need to be cured from gender dysphoria.
Cured meaning?
Meaning that gender dysphoria taken away so that they feel comfortable in their birth gender. And there are other psychologists and social workers who feel that we should be helping these kids affirm their gender feelings rather than trying to cure them. A situation exactly analogous with what went on with homosexuality.
Right. That sounds very, very familiar.
I might
go ahead. Sure.
Here. There's a prime example of that Dr. Sills made us aware of a few weeks ago, and that is a woman who is biologically a woman plays basketball on the George Washington University basketball team, but she thinks of herself as a man. And so they view this as a male member of the George Washington women's basketball team.
And they put that on the website as
they
a male member.
On the web. This is on Yahoo News Network. It may have appeared elsewhere. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, the question is if she's getting testosterone therapy, which is what I give to my older adolescents and young adults, the women born as women who think that they're men. I don't know where the ethics lies of her then playing with other women if
there
she's getting
issues too, NCAA issues.
Right, and whether it's if she's not getting testosterone therapy and she just sees herself as a as a man, then I can't see that there's any issue. But yeah, it depends on how she's being treated.
The article says that she will not begin any medical or drug protocols until, well, he graduates, in order to preserve his eligibility on the women's basketball team. You would infer that she's not, or he is not, getting treatment
exactly
at this time.
So that's just perfectly fine.
It just raises to me the specter of how complex and difficult it must be, though, to function in our society where, again, as you pointed out earlier before the break, how in biology we may actually be somewhere between, or we may feel different than our biology dictates. And yet society has said, no, you are either male or female. And if you vary from that, there's all this stigma and consequences that emerge.
So, and they're very practical things, too. I mean, we are segregated according to gender or sex. You use a men or a women's
laboratory,
bathroom, and so on. So those things have to be sorted out for people who fall somewhere in between.
Are there true hermaphrodites? I mean, out of my own ignorance.
Well, hermaphrodites occur. That means the sexual, biologic sexual characteristics of both genders. And they occur in all animals. Maybe they even occur in plants, don't they?
Oh, I don't know about that.
But in that
well,
case...
Well, there's some plants that are bisexual.
Uh-huh. Right,
they
right.
fertilize themselves, basically.
Uh-huh. Exactly. So I guess the question here, and I think the thing that is, from an ethical standpoint, is how, first of all, does a decision need to be made by the parents? In the case of a young child, when you're saying that you can have those kinds of feelings or awareness when you're quite young, that you are born in the wrong body, so to speak, how then does a parent intervene, okay, if at all? Mm-hmm. And then, of course, physicians and their own biases obviously come and play a role. Can
well,
you speak to that?
The studies that I'm aware of to date show that some of the kids who express these gender dysphoric feelings will not be true transsexual adults. A percentage of them will go on to lead homosexual or lesbian or gay lives. So some kids are not going to the extent of becoming transsexuals.
Meaning they don't actually want to be the other sex.
Right.
They
right.
just are then attracted in their sexual orientation
They're expressing gender dysphoria, but it's not to the degree that would make them want to change their gender. So the best advice you can give parents is day by day. You support a child's right to be an individual, to have interests. If you have a son who prefers to wear a ballet costume, you let them wear the ballet costume in the house. Obviously, you have to help them negotiate those waters publicly, which is very, very tricky and very dependent upon school and clubs and the open-mindedness of people in those situations. But you have to explain to a child how difficult it is to sometimes be misunderstood.
Now, as a pediatrician, you obviously deal with this issue repeatedly, whether it's gender dysmorphia or almost anything, in terms of parents making decisions for kids, right?
Right.
So I guess the question here is, when or is it ever appropriate for the parent to make the decision one way or another as to what the child becomes?
Well, as a general rule, and this is an ethical principle, but also a medical one, too, and a legal one, parents do make decisions for children, and children are defined as anyone below 18. Now, we all know that a 16-year-old is much different than a 6-year-old, and so we look at this as sort of a sliding scale of autonomy on the part of the child and so on. But and in the large, large majority of cases, parents do have the best interests of their child at heart, and we rely on that, as I say, legally, ethically, medically. But I think this is where Dr. Sills and her like-minded colleagues come in. I mean, I think parents need a lot of guidance here, and what a parent think is right for a 6-year-old may not be right when that child is 8 or 10 or 14 and so on.
Yeah, I mean, there are even therapists who will tell parents that if your daughter is reaching for the baseball bat, put a doll in their hands, that this is a disease that needs to be fixed.
You pointed
so
that out.
So they can
earlier.
Find therapists who will try to cure these urges. That's not my approach, and that's not my approach is much more open-ended and liberal, and you let your child choose the toys that they want to play with, whatever gender characteristics they have, because we do that anyhow.
But clearly, that's your bias, and I think personally I would lean towards the same bias and feel like it allows the child to blossom fully. But the fact is, not all physicians are like
that. But I think most pediatricians today understand that there are perfectly virile men who are going to grow up and want to be a ballet dancer or want to be a stay-at-home dad.
But that's different than becoming a woman.
It's different than becoming a woman, but I think the idea is you have to support your child's interests and their strengths and their skills and their hopes. And if you have a girl who wants to become president of the United States, that may not be a typically feminine role, but it's becoming a real possibility. And why would you squash that?
No, I totally support that notion. And that really grows out of the whole issue, the whole feminist movement of people fully developing their, you know, their fullest potential. But to me, the difference here is whether a young child should or can be helped to change gender. Okay. Well, so for example, just briefly, because we are running out of time, when you talk about intervention, what type of medical intervention do you advocate? And is there surgical intervention advocated for children?
No, there's no surgical intervention for children. The first decision point is when a child starts in puberty. So that's typically around 11 or 12 years. And today, the evolving recommendations are that we can turn off puberty in children who are developing puberty in the, quote, wrong gender, giving them more time to have mental health therapy to decide if this is a decision that is going to be long-lasting.
So that's the technique.
That's the first decision point for parents. So that's not until they're 11 or 12.
And at that point, you basically retard, so to speak, endocrinologically retard their puberty so they have the opportunity to really be certain. Because you did mention at the break that some of this may be more of a reflection of adolescent angst or adolescent rebellion, and that maybe later in life they would feel, no, in fact, I really am my original sex.
That's what the worry is. I will tell you that my experience is the kids who come to see me, they know what they want. There is really none of this
uncertainty.
Yeah, it's not. Nobody would put themselves into this position unless they were serious.
Well, this is a very, a very complex topic, obviously, and there's so much more we could talk about, but we are running out of time. Tell me where people can turn for help.
Well, at the Joslin Center, we see patients other than patients with diabetes. And we have physicians who will see children with gender dysphoria and adolescents and adults who would like endocrinologic help. We have a lot of resources in this community. The Goldberg Family Center at Syracuse University provides mental health therapy.
Wonderful. So the Joslin Center, located across from Nottingham High School on Genesee Street, is a place to go to get some help in that regard. Or
the medical help we can provide. We don't provide the mental health therapy, but we can help you
find
locate that too.
Mm-hmm. Well, Dr. Gregory Eastwood, Professor of Bioethics and Humanities, Professor of Medicine at Upstate Medical University, and Dr. Irene Sills, Professor of Pediatrics at Upstate Medical University, thank you so much for joining us with this very complex and really difficult topic, challenging topic. We have to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more HealthLink on Air. I'm Linda Cohen, and this is FM News Radio 106.9 WSYR.